This morning at 7 a.m., the union representing those who man America's air traffic control facilities called a strike. I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
I'm Mark Levitt, and welcome to Action Speaks, Underappreciated Dates That Changed America. We're taping from the Cafe at AS 220 in Down City, Providence, Rhode Island, home of Triple Deckers, Artisan Lofts, and the confluence of the not-quite-so-mighty Winnisquituckett and Providence Rivers. Today, our topic is the 1981 firing by President Ronald Reagan, a former union president himself, of the air traffic controllers, ushering in a period of difficulty for the union movement in general and for federal, state, and municipal workers in particular. Here, Governor Walker of Wisconsin talks about how President Reagan's swift action on those who guided our airplanes in and out of airports inspired him in what was revealed as a prank call from a supposedly David Koch, a conservative billionaire.
30 years ago, Ronald Reagan had one of the most defining moments of his political career, not just his presidency, when he fired the air traffic controllers. To me, that moment was more important than just for labor relations or even the federal budget. That was the first crack in the Berlin Wall and the fall of communism, because from that point forward, the Soviets and the communists knew that Ronald Reagan wasn't a pushover.
To help us more fully appreciate the importance and implication of President Reagan's actions are our panelists. Dr. Joseph McCartan is an associate professor of history at Georgetown University. His new book is Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Mike Downey is the president of Rhode Island Council 94 AFS. CME APSME. He followed his father and grandfather into a career as a plumber. He went to LaSalle Academy, and after LaSalle, he went to plumbing school, a five-year program of work in classes. He was also on the town council of the little town of Charlestown, down where I live in South County, Rhode Island. And Paul Cannon was an air traffic controller for 13 years in Boston. He was a president of a PATCO local between 1975 and 1979, stepping down to be one of the first choir boys in New England. Later, he became a business agent for the Teamster Local 122. I welcome you all. Thank you very much for coming here at AS 220. I appreciate it. So what's the significance of this date? Paul, what do you think?
Well, actually, this was the 30th anniversary, and for the last 30 years, we've seen the slippage of the labor movement's influence in the country. And the PATCO strike may not have been what caused that, but it certainly was what helped it along. It exposed the weakness of labor at the time. It gave a lot of impetus to a lot of employers who would just as soon see their unions gone and be able to do what they will with their workers. And now we're coming up and seeing the difference in the 1% and the 99% and also the reaction to that here in Providence and Boston and on Wall Street.
Joseph McCartan, you chose this date to write a whole book. It's about 400 pages, a wonderful book, by the way. But I'm curious why you chose this moment to spend your time, which probably was up to 2, 3, 4 years, to write a book about.
Oh, it was many more years, about 13, to really adequately research and document and then tell this very important story. What happened 30 years ago when the air traffic controllers struck on August 3rd and then were fired 2 days later when they defied the ultimatum that President Ronald Reagan threw down to them within hours of walking off their jobs. That event, I think, set a tone that still has yet to be changed, a tone where labor has been embattled, and we see protests emerging around the country, as Paul noted, by the 99% against a system that has unduly rewarded the top 1%.
Michael Downey, as a current organizer and president of a union in Rhode Island, how does this event 30 years before have significance in your actions and your conduct as a union president?
I believe the significance of the firing of public employees, that being Patco workers, to this day still prevails. And the outrage from different politicians, similar to me, just like President Reagan, that I've had to confront right here in Rhode Island, to name one, Governor Kachiri. I'm glad that he's no longer governor, but he, too, was of that same vein. If we ever decided to take what state employees cannot legally go on strike, but had we ever decided, I think he would have used the same kind of actions that President Reagan did. So I find the date very significant, and it turned back the workers' rights, and it's been a long time trying to bring them back. And to this day, that struggle still continues here in Rhode Island.
Paul Cannon, I want to kind of paint a picture of who an air traffic controller is, where they worked, what the conditions were when you joined, and how those conditions might have led to the formation of a union.
The controllers work in two different types of facilities, in a tower that most of us are familiar with, and radar rooms, or air traffic control centers, which, like the facility I worked in Nashua, New Hampshire, control the all the traffic in New England, out over the ocean, and a good part of upstate New York. Under a management system that said, you know, we'll buy the equipment and we'll develop the procedures and all of the rest of it, and you make it work. So the controller, going way back then, tried to get a stronger voice into not only the way things were done in the control room, but also over, like everybody else, the pay and working conditions and benefits of the job.
That and yet you saw yourselves as professionals. You didn't see yourselves as industrial unionists. You saw yourselves as professional who were somewhat reluctant to form a union initially.
They were reluctant to call it a union, but they very much wanted the union without the name, I guess, is because they wanted to keep that mantra of being professional, yes.
And who were those people? Where were they from? Were they primarily, quote, white? Were they...
Oh, absolutely, yeah. White, male, in the 60s and the 70s, yeah.
And did they earn more than, say, industrial unionists would have made then? Was there a certain...
Well, some. The pay structure depended on the facility that you worked in. Most of them came out of the military, is basically the common thread among all of them. They were people that joined the military, either got into air traffic control or, like myself, got into radar in the Navy, and that's the foot in the door.
Joe McCartan, was it unusual that people like this should be forming into at least a union by action and not by name? What problems did they have as they began to realize that they had collective issues?
Well, it wasn't completely unusual. PATCO was formed in 1968, which I believe, Paul, that was the year you joined the FAA and Paul became a controller. Air travel exploded between 1960 and 1968. The FAA had trouble keeping up with its growth, and that created tensions in the workplace. There were mandatory 6-day work weeks for some controllers in the mid-60s, so they were responding to those kinds of issues. They were in part inspired by what teachers were doing in the 60s, another group that you could say are professionals, not industrial workers, but they were also unionizing, and they were winning improvements, both smaller classrooms, sizes, and improved salaries for themselves, better benefits, making the career being a teacher a more sustainable career. So in some ways, the controllers were experiencing something similar.
And, in fact, organizations like your own, Michael, AFSCME, was very active in the unionization and, in fact, organizing of strikes in the 1960s under Jerry Wirth, a very political and a very left-wing and activist union leader. Am I correct?
Absolutely. Jerry Wirth was one of the best organizers, at least, of course, I'm from AFSCME, so I certainly would have to point him out as one of the better organizers, especially with the AFSCME. But the current president, Jerry McEntee, is a maverick himself in organizing. And we've always been part of things. I go back to even in the 60s, my father was an organizer with AFSCME in Rhode Island, and that's when we started to organize most of the municipalities, state employees, and the people that we now represent in Council 94. It's very difficult to organize. I've done some organizing in my 5 years as president of Rhode Island Council 94. And with all the tough things that are going on in the state, we have been successful. Maybe it's turning a little bit in that people want to join unions when they see how bad management's treating them. We've been successful in the past 2 or 3 years in organizing 700 new members to our organization. So AFSCME will continue, but has always, since the 60s, been very dedicated to organizing new members.
And yet, Joseph McCartan, the idea that public employees should strike was anathema for many, many years for many, many people. After all, they protect the public safety. After all, that they have to give up their own individual good for the good of the country. And in fact, there was legislation beginning to develop quite early, making it impossible for public, municipal, state workers to strike. Is that's true?
That's absolutely right. I think many people will date the feeling that developed against public sector workers striking back to the infamous Boston police strike, which happened in 1919, in which Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge made the famous statement.
It's a familiar name.
Yes, and actually one that inspired Ronald Reagan. Reagan had Coolidge's portrait up in the White House. And Coolidge, during that conflict, said that no one had the right to strike against the public safety. He called out the National Guard in Massachusetts in 1919, broke that strike. After the Boston police strike, very few public sector workers of any kind wanted to risk a strike. Believing that the public would not support it. Every state and the federal government had laws against striking for their workers. That didn't change into the post-World War II period, although there was a flurry of public sector strikes right after World War II. Some states came down really hard against that. In Ohio, they enacted something called the Ferguson Act. In New York, it was called the Condon-Wadlin Act. And in each of those acts, the penalty was if you struck, you would lose your job. But over the course of the 1960s, a shift in attitude happened. I think part of it came out of the civil rights struggle. And part of it came out of unions like Michael's, AFSCME, led by Jerry Wirth in the 1960s. And in fact, it was AFSCME, Michael's union, that followed exactly that idea in 1968 in Memphis, when sanitation workers, who did not have a right to strike, walked off their jobs in protest after two sanitation workers were crushed to death in the back of a sanitation machine that malfunctioned. They struck. To their aid came Martin Luther King, sort of symbolizing this fusion of the rights of the public worker and civil rights. And King portrayed that strike as a fundamental human right. These workers need to be able to express themselves and walk out. They actually ended up winning a contract. And so by the end of the 1960s, there was a growing feeling that this ban on strikes was anachronistic and that a new day was dawning and that government workers deserved rights. It was precisely at that moment that PATCO itself was formed. Really, PATCO was founded in January 68. The Memphis strike happened about a month later, and King was assassinated in April. So all these things kind of came together.
Well, just in regards to the Memphis strike, we celebrated, AFSCME did, celebrated the Martin Luther King being with the Memphis workers, and it's something that recently was celebrated. I now have in my office some very nice signs that say, I am a man, and that's the type of signs, that is the sign that was vogue during that strike, and AFSCME has recreated that just with the new opening of the Martin Luther King statue in Washington, D.C.
I'll get a little away from the chronology that I'm drawing out now by making connections to the present. You are now engaged in another alliance that could bear fruit. Could you describe that?
We're beginning to become engaged with this new group that is now occupying Providence at Burnside Park. As we feel, they're sticking up for the right things, and that Those are the people that took pensions away from public employees, a whole nother saga that's working out in Rhode Island.
A saga which is playing out to this day. And I wonder when you see or hear Governor Walker talk or the legislations that are beginning to be recommended in Ohio or New Hampshire. Paul, I wonder what your feeling is as you hear those kinds of discussions about issue of everything from striking employees to pensions. How do you feel as you hear that? Is it an echo of the past? Or you?
It gets sickening. You know, it really, really turns my stomach when you when I hear those people. It was a long, hard time getting over the PATCO strike for all of us that were involved. It probably easier for me than most. But the difficult thing to watch has been the way that the respect for workers has deteriorated over the period since, and that's exactly what it is. It's respect, you know. When a person on the job doesn't have a voice, and when the person on the job can't talk about, you know, what's fair and equitable for to come back to him in the way of compensation, without being told that we're going to take your union away if you're a state employee, or we're going to change the law with you having no recourse. It's really irritating. So
you're actually, though, describing a process that really was, I mean, there was always an underlying anti-union feeling in the country itself, dating back to the initial organizing in the 1880s of the industrial unionism. So that was always there. But in some ways, throughout the 1930s, there was, and the full organization of industrial unionism, there was sort of a detente reached in some ways between the 1940s, between labor and business. But there was beginning to be a shift in the early 70s.
I think that's exactly the overview. Coming out of the 1930s and 40s, there was a great breakthrough made by working people through unions. And basically what it amounted to was the recognition of collective bargaining as the American way, basically, from the Wagner Act in 1935. In addition to the signs, "I am a man," that were carried in Memphis, were signs that read, "Collective bargaining is the American way." And that, I think, was a broadly felt feeling in this country in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. But as the 60s gave way to the 70s and the upheaval of the 60s let loose many different political forces in the country, including a revived conservative movement, business people by the early 70s were ready to try to change that equation. So by the early 1970s, in 1972, a group called the Business Roundtable was formed. Business people became increasingly militant in fighting unions. All of that was well underway years before Ronald Reagan was elected. But in some ways, you could say that Reagan's election in 1980 was the fruit of this emerging conservative backlash that unfolded over the course of the 1970s. But I would draw a kind of distinction between Reagan and the present time. Reagan was surely a conservative. He came down hard on PATCO and broke it. But there was still a difference between Reagan and people who call themselves Reaganites today, including people like Scott Walker in Wisconsin. That is, Reagan once had led a union, the Screen Actors Guild. He actually did speak favorably of that experience, even in his presidential years. We didn't hear in the clip that began this show today. He actually reminded television audiences that day when he laid down this ultimatum that he once had led a union in a strike. He believed in the strike for the private sector.
"I respect the right of workers in the private sector to strike. Indeed, as president of my own union, I led the first strike ever called by that union. I guess I'm maybe the first one to ever hold this office who is a lifetime member of an AFL-CIO union. But we cannot compare labor-management relations in the private sector with government. Government cannot close down the assembly line. It has to provide without interruption the protective services which are government's reason for being."
Reagan actually was not as strong an opponent of collective bargaining as people like Scott Walker today. What he did with PATCO was he drew the line on the idea of the strike. What we're seeing now is something far more radical, in other words, than what Reagan proposed. We're seeing people that want to eradicate collective bargaining altogether. And that's basically what Scott Walker has tried to do in Wisconsin, what's happening in Ohio and some other places.
Do you see that, Michael, in your work?
Yes, I do. When you had brought up the name Walker right away, I knew I would have to comment at some point. And I would agree with the professor here that Ronald Reagan certainly didn't create a monster like Mr. Walker. In Wisconsin, what they did was strip employees of their collective bargaining rights. It was nothing to do with a strike. Since that time, though, AFSCME again, and other unions too, have made a little political noise there. And if I'm not mistaken, at least three or four senators and reps have been taken out in a recall from their jobs. So, and right here in Rhode Island, last General Assembly, they stripped state employees of their right to longevity. That was something we always collectively bargained. So it's right in our own doorstep, too. But I don't think President Reagan would have been proud of the moves that Governor Walker is doing to the people in Wisconsin.
In fact, and I hate to bring this up, I know we've talked about it, Paul, PATCO broke from the rest of the union movement and actually endorsed President Reagan's presidency.
To the against the counsel of myself, I would say. As we look at back at that, though, the administration before, President Carter, he appointed a FAA director named Langhorne Bourne, who gave us a lot of trouble. And we had what they called an immunity program to allow controllers and pilots to report incidents that were happening across the system without being disciplined for it. What happened was that raised the level of reported incidents significantly, but it hadn't changed what was happening. The incidents were what the incidents were. Bourne came along and said, well, you know, we want to get the number of reported incidents down, so we took away immunity. And in the process of taking away immunity and a couple of the other things that he did, he just denigrated the work of the controller and spoke as if they, you know, were not the professionals that we thought we were. So there was a hostile atmosphere with the Carter appointees. So I guess Poli thought that Reagan, once he got a promise from Reagan that he would help us out, that the Reagan endorsement would make sense for the PATCO.
So angered at Carter and angered at the increasingly difficult conditions under which you're working and the difficulty of engaging in meaningful collective bargaining, somehow this group of air traffic controllers make a decision to strike, even with the threat of imprisonment.
We just heard a discussion about how public sector strike were becoming more commonplace, how even the postal workers were on strike, government employees, federal government employees were on strike. So our battle cry was the only unlawful strike is the unsuccessful strike. So you know, we kind of anticipated a lot of drum beating that people would go to jail and we'd all be fired, and we never expected it to happen because our thing was if we had 80%, we couldn't lose. What they did was they changed the system.
And yet Joe McCartan...
Let me add to what Paul has said a couple of things. I think it can't be stressed enough the precedent that was set in 1970 when about 100,000 postal workers engaged in a wildcat strike. They weren't fired. The other important thing that should be said is that what led to the PATCO tragedy, I think, is that federal workers, like air traffic controllers, didn't really have the right to bargain over the things they really wanted to bargain over. In fact, federal workers didn't have a right to bargain over what their salaries were, what their benefits were, how long their work week was. That was forbidden, in fact, by federal law. So what, in a sense, drove them toward a strike was the fact that the only way that they could ever get the government to do these things, that is, talk to them about these things, would be to threaten to shut down the system.
And yet at the same time, a parallel force is operating. The United States economy is undergoing its shift from a manufacturing to a service sector economy. And there's a sort of a dislocation of workers around the country. At the same time, there's that libertarian philosopher named
Sylvester Petro,
who's beginning to circulate his ideas about what?
Well, he argued very strongly that, you know, any kind of collective bargaining for public workers with government was an infringement on government sovereign powers, so that any government that bargained with its employees was in fact subverting itself. So there was an increasingly aggressive conservative movement happening at the same time as vast changes in our economy having to do with the beginning of globalization, the end of the industrial center of the economy, or at least its transformation. All those things, I think, were opening up a moment of almost unique vulnerability for working people. And it's at precisely that moment that this turning point strike occurred. And that's, I think, why it had such a deep impact.
Michael Downey?
I just would agree with the professor in that the changes, I've been involved now 30 years, and I really haven't seen any good times. I'm waiting for them to come. So as a public employee, I would say, though, the past 3 to 4 to 5 years are even worse than my first 25 years.
Would you consider a strike?
Well, I would consider a strike. I just would not want to be arrested. My family does like me and would rather have me be home. But should the way they treat employees continue here in Rhode Island, I could understand people getting upset enough to maybe not plow the roads when it's snowing or take care of the so-called problems at DMV, where we represent those workers, where the real problem is there's not enough workers, has nothing to do with them taking breaks or taking their lunch breaks too long. If they continue to keep thinking that we can concede and concede and concede, I would think that at some point there may be some type of action up to and including a strike for public employees in Rhode Island.
I love the diplomacy of your comment.
The right to strike. This was just a crucial thing for American workers over the course of the labor movement's history. In the 1950s, there were lots of strikes. That was also an era of great shared prosperity. And that's really what started to go away after the PATCO strike. And before PATCO, we averaged about 280 major strikes a year. After PATCO, that went off a cliff. In 2009, there were 5. So from 280-some to 5. So that has contributed to this vast growing inequality that we're now facing, in which people are now protesting.